Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. I'm in for Brian Lehrer, Jamie Floyd with you again today. And we begin, of course, with the markets. As you may have heard on the newscast, the Dow dropped more than 300 points at the open. Now, yesterday, the news was slightly better than it had been in the last several days, triggered by a Federal Reserve pledge to keep interest rates super low for the next 2 years to help the ailing U.S. economy. The Dow finished another roller coaster day on Tuesday with a 429-point gain, and Asian and European markets also rallied, although futures were down. Not just the last several days, but really the summer has been dominated by a whole lot of economic navel-gazing here in the United States, the debt ceiling debate in D.C., and of course, in recent days, the controversial downgrade by Standard & Poor's of our credit rating from AAA to AA+. But if we take a moment to lift our head up, there is a much bigger story to be told, the story of the world economic crisis. So today we want to return to that story and examine specifically the link between the European debt crisis and our own. And we want to hear from you on this, especially those of you with ties to Europe or who may have family there. What is your understanding of that connection, especially as it affects your own lives? 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or go to WNYC.org and post a comment. I'm joined now by award-winning columnist Joe Nocera, who writes about business for the New York Times. He's also author of the recent book, All Devils Are Here: The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. Joe, with that title, who better to have on the show this week, right?
How are you?
How are you? Thank you so much for joining us. You've also written a piece just this week, which should serve as a wake-up call about the, quote, never-ending turmoil in Europe. We're going to take a deep dive into your piece in a moment, and specifically into that part of the piece. But first, a quick conversation about the Fed. What exactly did they announce yesterday, and what has been the apparent impact of that, at least until this morning's open?
Well, you know, the Fed announced yesterday that the zero interest rate policy that is currently in effect will remain until 2013. That is a pretty astonishing announcement, because the Fed, often makes interest rates decisions on a meeting-by-meeting basis, which is quarterly and sometimes even more frequently than that. So it's really to say, to basically look out of the horizon and say, we don't expect the economy to rebound much between now and then, therefore we feel we have no choice but to keep interest rates at or near zero, is quite an astonishment. Now, that was only yesterday afternoon. And, you know, the same announcement exists this morning as it did yesterday. Yesterday, it caused a 200-point downturn to turn into a 400-point upturn by the end of the day, in a moment of sort of volatility and sort of nutty euphoria. Today, the same set of facts are in place, and the market opened down 300 points. So the truth is, Jamie, you really can't say that this announcement has had any effect, good or bad, for the market. The market is in the midst of an extraordinary amount of volatility, which is fueled by an extraordinary amount of fear. And so, you know, there's this sort of giddiness, and then there's this depression. And, you know, from my point of view, volatility is a bad thing, because it means people are scared and they don't know quite what to do. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's going to be a while before we sort things out and see what the market is going to do. Having said all that, the market is less important than the real economy and far less important than what's going on in Europe.
And I do want to get to Europe, but I also want to get your reaction, because you also had an opinion about the remarks of President Obama, which may or may not have had some impact on the markets. Let's take a quick listen to some of what he had to say less than 24 hours before the Fed announcement.
There will always be economic factors that we can't control. Earthquakes, spikes in oil prices, slowdowns in other parts of the world. But how we respond to those tests, that's entirely up to us. Markets will rise and fall, but this is the United States of America. No matter what some agency may say, we've always been and always will be a AAA country.
Now, Joe Nocera, I know from reading your piece that you agree with part of the substance of that. There will be forces beyond our control. But what was your overall impression of President Obama's remarks made on Monday?
I think that he is, you know, for all the excitement he generated as a rhetorician, as a speechmaker during the campaign, his economic pronouncements have been not very good, and this one was particularly banal and uninspiring. It is painful to see somebody so gifted leaving the country so cold on something so important. I have various theories as to why this is so, but you know, mine are only theories. What the fact is that we need some leadership from the White House. We need some inspiration from the White House in this very difficult time when job growth remains sluggish to non-existent, unemployment remains high. We are actually veering towards a recession, another recession. We may not get there, but that's certainly the direction we seem to be headed. The Fed is out of bullets. That's why they did their announcement. They really don't have any monetary strategy anymore to do anything. And our fiscal policy, i.e. Congress, is at such loggerheads that they are not only not helping, they are actually causing S&P to downgrade our debt.
Now,
so, you know, where's the president?
Yeah, yeah. And you see a connection, as do many analysts, and now I want to take a turn to Europe, between our crisis here and the economic crisis overseas. Ben Bernanke apparently agrees. Here he is. This is not yesterday, but way back, Joe, on Sunday on Meet the Press. Take a listen.
The United States was actually doing relatively well, sluggish, but going forward until Italy ran into trouble.
All right. So help us to understand the connection, Joe Nocera. Let's
First of all, that was not Bernanke. That was the much discredited Alan Greenspan. Let's keep that in mind.
I'm sorry. I was misinformed on that. But let's talk about Europe and your piece, which he is much discredited. But your piece, which is aptly titled "While the Markets Swoon," and you posted that on Monday, which is the first trading day after the S&P downgrade, you call the whole S&P story a sideshow. That's your word, not mine. And why so? You say that the sleepless nights should be spent on the never-ending turmoil in Europe, quoting you.
Well, first of all, it really doesn't matter what S&P says about our debt. What matters is whether we are willing as a country to pay our debts. Okay? That's what counts. And you know, the debt crisis notwithstanding, we did show in this crisis that, for now, we're willing to prevent the country from going into default. So you know, honestly, it's mildly irrelevant what S&P does. They have a right to downgrade, and on some level, perhaps it's even their job, but it doesn't mean we really have to pay much attention to it. It also gave the Chinese some bragging rights. They could wag their finger at us and so on and so forth. But ultimately, it's not going to affect our economy all that much. What could affect our economy is what's going on in Europe. And you say to yourself, well, how can that be? And the answer is contagions can spread. That's number one. I mean, look, what started as a problem with Greece and Ireland and Portugal, what they like to call the peripheral countries, has now hit Italy and Spain. Okay, there are actually rumors that France could be next, just like Morgan Stanley was next after Lehman Brothers and Goldman was set up after that, even though they had plenty of money. You know, it becomes a confidence thing. And then the point that I made in my column is that, you know, in the 1930s, long before money, you know, moved electronically from one place to another, long before then, You know, an Austrian bank failed in 1931, and that caused a contagion of failure in Europe, which then really did jump the Atlantic and begin a contagion of bank failures in the United States, which helped exacerbate the Great Depression enormously. There is no... If Europe really fails, the euro fails, somebody decides to default or drop out of the European Union, if the European central banks can't contain this problem, which they're desperately trying to contain, but they don't have the resources of the Federal Reserve, it is absolutely possible that this contagion of fear could jump the ocean, could hit our banks, could hit our government, could hit our debt. And that is what's worth worrying about.
But there's the old expression, and sometimes it's attributed to Santayana, sometimes Churchill, those who fail to learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. If that's the case, then what do you advise the course of action is in the present vis-a-vis European debt and the U.S. financial crisis?
Well, I don't think we have a historical precedent for this because we've never had a situation where European countries have given up their financial autonomy to be part of a central union. Mm. So what Greece would normally do in this situation, I mean, they would need IMF help and they would have to tighten their belt, but basically they would devalue their currency. That's what countries do in this situation. And they might even default the way Argentina did. But Greece is in a position where it doesn't have a currency it can default because it gave that up for the euro, and it can't really default because it basically brings down the rest of the entire European Union. So history is actually not very helpful in this moment. And one of the reasons policymakers are having such trouble dealing with this problem is because it's not a national problem; it's a region-wide problem, and they don't really have the region-wide tools to deal with it. That's why the Germans are the ones who are being asked basically to step up and put up the money to save the rest of Europe. Well, you're going to get to a point where the German population, actually they're pretty close to reaching that point, is going to say, enough already, we are tired of propping up all these spendthrifts in Greece.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Joe Nocera, award-winning author and columnist for the New York Times. We're taking your calls, especially from those of you with a connection to Europe, about the European debt crisis and the possible link to our own. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Rick is calling in. He's here in Manhattan. Rick, you are on WNYC with Joe Nocera. Please go ahead.
Hi. I would like to express the view that it isn't a regional problem, and it isn't a domestic problem in the U.S. That is, in Europe, it isn't a real problem. It's a worldwide problem. And the problem is that we've set up a trade system that permits countries to benefit from free trade while building up huge trade surpluses. In 2007, there were trade surpluses among oil-producing countries and non-oil-producing countries in the neighborhood of about $1.4 trillion, and that is about equal to the production lost by 5% excess unemployment in Europe and the United States once the debt-creating machine that kept the economy moving until the credit crisis stopped. My point is that it's a worldwide sort of Keynesian macroeconomic problem. There's a demand deficiency, and it's built into trade surpluses. We need to put into trade agreements a requirement of balanced trade, which is the kind of thing that Warren Buffett proposed in 2005. And I think we should consider something like an oil import fee to raise the cost of imported oil and take money out of the sovereign wealth funds of the oil-producing countries and put it back into demand for currently produced goods and services.
Rick, thank you for your call. A very well-thought-out proposal. Joe Nocera, your thoughts on that and reaction.
Well,
It's a lot. He has both a theory and a proposal.
There's a lot of really smart ideas and thoughts in there. However, free trade has done the world a wealth of good. It is absolutely true that there are countries with giant trade surpluses because they have low-cost labor and for other reasons as well. Some of it's manipulative, some of it is not. There are things that we can do. You know, United States has let it doesn't have a manufacturing policy, and we have allowed manufacturing to drift abroad. The United States could stop foreign oil tomorrow if we were willing to switch to, you know, hydrofracking, which everyone in New York State is violently opposed to. And every time I say it could help create some energy independence and, you know, wean us from the surpluses we are handing to OPEC oil, people are up in arms and say, well, it's going to wreck my water. So, you know, there are trade-offs in life that could help us in this situation, but which right-thinking people are opposed to.
Hmm. And we thank you, Rick, very much for the call. And we take one now from Scott in Queens. Scott, you are on WNYC with Joe Nocera.
Yes, good morning, guys. My question is, in regards to the European Union, which country benefits the most from being in the Union and which one benefits the least? And the reason I ask is I'm still trying to figure out what benefits Italy from being in the Union? Because I could see it easily opting out of the Union. Just wanted to know what your thoughts were.
Thank you, Scott, for the question. So, Joe, which countries do benefit the most and which benefits the least? And is opting out really an option?
Opting out is certainly an option. I mean, these are sovereign nations. They have the right to say, we don't want to do this anymore. We're going to set up our own country. It would be a disaster for the rest of Europe. The European Union, until this crisis, the European Union was generally perceived as one of the great economic triumphs of the modern age. It created a giant free trade zone. It allowed, you know, people in Greece to move to Spain and get a job there. It created a lot of wealth, and that's why people are loath to give it up. The crisis has shown what's wrong with it, that sovereign nations don't have control of their own currency, for instance, and that the strong countries have to prop up the weak countries at a time of crisis, which creates political problems in those countries. It may not ultimately be sustainable. There was we had Christine Lagarde, the new head of the IMF, who was the former finance minister of France, was in the New York Times not all that long ago, and we asked her point blank, is the euro worth it? And she said unquestionably yes, but she never really gave a reason why. And I found that illuminating.
Yes, the one-word answer of a former synchronized swimmer. Joe, I finally want to ask you to take a listen to something. It's a little out of the ordinary, but the reason will become clear in just a moment to you and to our listeners. It's an exchange that Matt Damon had with a reporter, Matt Damon, the actor, of course. It's making the rounds on YouTube. Take a listen. The first voice you hear is the voice of the reporter asking the question.
It's criminal that, like, we're, you know, that so little is asked of people who are getting so much. I mean, I don't mind paying more. I really don't mind paying more taxes. I'd rather pay for taxes than cut, like, you know, Reading is Fundamental or, you know, Head Start or some of these, like, programs that are really helping kids. I mean, why not? This is the greatest country in the world. Is it that much worse if you pay 6% more in taxes? Give me a break.
Okay, that's the actor Matt Damon. We didn't hear the reporter. The question was originally, should wealthy people pay more taxes? And he goes on, Joe Nocera, to say that people with more than $5 million, the super rich, should pay 50% after $5 million. Of course, he's not running for Congress. He's not an economist. He's not running for president. But he's pretty specific. Raise taxes on the wealthy. And then to the question of whether wealthy people are using their Bush tax breaks to start a small business and create jobs, he says, quote, As a wealthy person, I know that they're just stashing their money away and that it's ridiculous. Now I'm paraphrasing, but he says it's crazy, I think, is the word he uses, to think that that is the use that is being made of the money. Now, I play that clip, Joe, because you end your column Monday in a very compelling way with a plea to wealthy people to do something very specific. Now, Joe, some of those people may be listening.
Well, first of all, some of them, there's this whole group called the, what do they call themselves? The Patriotic Millionaires. There's like a couple hundred of them that have basically said that you should raise, we should raise taxes on the wealthy.
Yes.
Most of them are liberals. And I'm really...
But not all.
But not all. And I would love to see... and apparently Ken Langone, who hardly qualifies as a liberal, has been calling for this. Apparently he did it on CNBC not all that long ago.
What is it, Joe, that you say at the end of your column, for the few who may not have seen it, what do you want them to do and why?
I would like people who are important, well-known businessmen who have real standing in the Republican Party, who will be listened to, you know, by the Eric Cantors of the world as well as more moderate Republicans, say it is right at this time of crisis, at a time of shared sacrifice, that the way the wealthy can share in the sacrifice is to pay more in taxes. That's what I would like to do. That's what I would like to see. I know there are people out there like that, like Ken Langone, and I think that is something the country badly needs. I want to say one other thing, though. Matt Damon is completely right in saying that that Republicans have this mantra that tax cuts are job creating, and that is their reason for opposing tax hikes on the rich. It's baloney. It's completely baloney. The United States was a high-growth country in the 1950s when the marginal tax rate was 90%. Ronald Reagan lowered taxes, but he also raised taxes. Bill Clinton had higher taxes than George Bush, but the economy was a whole lot better under Clinton than it was under Bush. There is certainly a level beyond which taxes hurt jobs, but we are so far from that, it is absurd.
Well, I feel another segment with Joe Nocera coming on, and we'll have you back.
Anytime.
We should do the taxation segment. Maybe we'll have Matt Damon on with you. And Langone. There we go, a three-way segment and all different views represented. The group, by the way, is the Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength. And it's patrioticmillionaires.org for those millionaires who may be listening and want to sign up. And Joe Nocera.
There are a lot of them, because let me tell you, they were sending me emails left and right last night because they were mad that
I hadn't mentioned them
in the column.
Good for you. You can name them all in the next column. And Joe Nocera, I want to thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Joe Nocera of the New York Times. His most recent book of many is All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Up next, the politics of the Port Authority. Stay with us.